percentage of power comes back, and so on. Just to give you an example, a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio means half the power you're trying to deliver gets reflected. Half power reflected, something like a 5.8 standing wave ratio load will do that for you. So that signal is going to come zooming back down your transmission line. Your antenna tuner, when it's properly set, when you're adjusting the antenna tuner, because with your antenna analyzer, you could have measured what impedance you see in the shack. Let me drop. Your antenna might really be a, 72 times 2 is 144, is that? Yeah, I think it's 144. Is that 14? That's something like 144. If I used a 144-ohm loading resistor on a 72-ohm cable, I would have a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Something like 10% of the power would be reflected back. And it would come back down the transmission line. And by the way, depending on the length of the transmission line, that signal reflected back to you is going to look like an inductor, a capacitor, a bigger resistor, or a smaller resistor. If the transmission line is an odd number of quarter wavelengths long, it gives you an impedance inversion. That's, of course, crazy. This one takes a lot of study to believe it. But if the antenna was inductive and the transmission line is a quarter wavelength long, then in the shack you will see capacitive reactance. Inductive becomes capacitive. If the antenna was capacitive, in the shack you'll see inductive. If the impedance of the antenna was high, in the shack you'll see something that's low. If the antenna, if it's a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio and the transmission line is a quarter wavelength long, a high impedance of the antenna will be a 2-to-1 impedance, standing wave ratio, low impedance in the shack. You'll see 37 ohms instead of 72, if you know what I mean. So a quarter wavelength of transmission line gives you an impedance inversion. A transmission line that's exactly a half wavelength long duplicates the impedance exactly. Whatever the impedance of the antenna is, you'll see that exact impedance in the shack if the transmission line is lossless. But in any of these cases, the antenna tuner can be placed at the antenna. If the antenna tuner has enough range, and you can predict, if you care to, what impedance you're going to get in the shack as a function of the length of the transmission line, again, the antenna tuner can correct for that impedance. So from one point of view, you think you're adjusting the knobs on the antenna tuner in order to do an impedance match between that impedance you see in the shack on that transmission line versus the 50 ohms of your transmitter, for instance. Let me drop. From one point of view, when you're adjusting the knobs on your antenna tuner, you're doing an impedance match. That happens to be real. There's another way of looking at it. What are you really doing with that impedance match? You can study this, and it's not easy to do the mathematics of this, but a couple of times I've done it, and I've done it with the help of other people, if you know what I mean. And that is, the signal reflecting back, when it hits the antenna tuner, because the antenna tuner output impedance is matching that crazy impedance of your transmission line, it is not a 50-ohm resistor. The output impedance of the antenna tuner is some other impedance. If looking into your antenna, you see an inductive reactance, your antenna tuner is output impedance is going to be capacitive in order to cancel that, so to speak. But what it's really doing, it's taking that reflected signal, the energy of that reflected signal, coming back down the transmission line because of this wire in that system, and re-reflecting it forward. And when you properly adjust the knobs on your antenna tuner, that signal being re-reflected forward is re-reflected forward with 100% reliability if your antenna tuner is lossless. If you use big enough components of high enough quality, you can make it essentially lossless. And you can prove to yourself that it's lossless if you buy a very good antenna tuner and run it at the 100-watt level for 10 solid minutes, and you'll find out when it's properly set, it runs ice cold. It's dissipating no energy in the form of heat. If it's well shielded, it's dissipating no energy with radiation. There's nothing left. It is taking that reflected energy and re-reflecting it forward. And it's taking that energy, reflected down the transmission line, re-reflecting it forward, all of it, 100% of it per se, and it's reflecting it forward in phase with the signal coming out of your transmitter right now. It gets voltage added to your transmitter. Let me drop. That that fact that I just said confuses the living daylights out of people. Because a guy could put his bird watt meter, a properly calibrated, thoroughly high-quality bird watt meter, he puts it at the input of his antenna tuner. When the antenna tuner is properly set, the antenna tuner, the bird watt meter at the input end, says all the power is going forward and none is coming back. You've got a one-to-one standing wave ratio at the input end of the antenna tuner. You take a second end bird watt meter and put it at the output end of the antenna tuner, and you're going to get confused at first. You're going to see more power, and you're going to see standing wave. You're going to see reflective power. If you had a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you might find with your 100-watt transmitter going into the antenna tuner that the bird watt meter on the output end is going to see 110 or 120 watts forward, and maybe 20 watts coming back. You're going to see reflected power and forward power, and the power you read forward with the bird watt meter on the output end will, in general, be greater than the power coming out of the transmitter. Of course that's confusing. Because energy is bouncing back and forth, and because your antenna, because your bird watt meter on the output end reads 120 watts, in my example, it doesn't mean you're radiating 120 watts. You're only radiating 100 in the ideal world. But 20 watts is bouncing back and forth with this particular example I'm giving right now. So you could call that reactive power, if you like, the extra power. So the bird watt meter on the output end confuses people. A number of smart people have said never put a bird watt meter on the output end. They think you're not allowed to put a bird watt meter in a highly reactive circuit. Well, when you're using your bird watt meter just to measure the direct connection between your transmitter, your transmission line, and your antenna, you're allowed to do that to measure what is the standing wave ratio. And the owner's manual on the bird watt meter gives you a bunch of curves as to this ratio of forward power to reverse power represents this particular standing wave ratio. Let me drop. It is perfectly legal to put a bird watt meter into any transmission line system that you desire. You're not violating any of the laws of physics when you do that. The interpretation may require a lot of explanation. It may not be so understandable the first time you do it, but you're allowed to do that. There's a ridiculous number of people who say, never put a bird watt meter on the output end. You can do it. As long as you know what you're about to see, as long as you've got it properly explained, the fact that there's extra apparent power there shouldn't get you really happy, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot more to this story than what I've given you so far. As I said, there's a lot more to it, but you're going to have to hear the story a number of times before it makes sense. I'm going to turn it back to you, Roy. HC2GS, KQRIW, and check that.
B2ASC question.
The main thing I'm trying to say is the bird watt meter, the antenna tuner, does not waste any power. AC2GS, go right ahead with your question, sir.
Dick, someone else wants to ask a question, I believe.
Yeah, I got the call letters wrong. That person, please give me your call letters and your name. The person who's got a further question. Go right ahead, sir.
W2ASC. Yeah, just a question regarding the illustration you just gave with the watt meter on each end of the antenna tuner. Are you saying two watt meters, one at the input and one at the output simultaneously, or just taking two separate measurements on two separate occasions with a single watt meter, if you understand what I'm saying?
You're giving me an either-or, and the answer is both. If you own a pair of bird watt meters, you can now put one on the input end of your antenna tuner and one on the output end. If you only own one bird watt meter, then you can do the experiment first by putting it on the input end and then put it on the output end. And as long as you're doing it on a frequency that's low enough where the length of the bird watt meter is not disturbing your system. If I did this experiment at 1296 megahertz, because the bird watt meter is, let me pick a number, 4 inches long, and 4 inches at 1296 megahertz is a significant portion of a wavelength. And therefore, putting the bird watt meter on the output end of the antenna tuner is changing the apparent length of the transmission line in some fraction of a wavelength, and therefore changing its impedance. And the interpretation becomes one step more complicated again. But if I'm putting that bird watt meter in there, at say, for instance, 10 meters and down, I can put it in either location one step at a time, or use two bird watt meters. Go borrow one from another friend and look at them simultaneously. You'll get the most exciting result if the input bird watt meter is reading 100 watts and the output bird watt meter is reading 120 watts forward and 20 watts coming back, and you'll say, gee, that is interesting. And the fact that you can see both of them simultaneously will give you a little bit more pleasure. W2ASC K2RIW. Please tell me your name, sir.
The name is Tony. Thank you, Dick. That sort of confused me for a second, but now that you say that, it does make a lot of sense. Thank you. I appreciate that.
W2TTT K2RIW. That man's in New Jersey. Go right ahead, sir.
For the moment, in a decent spot. Good evening, Dick. It's Gordon here. My observation is doing that. You also have to list it with a dummy load on the frequencies in question. Consider checking to see if the element is behaving the same way in each watt meter, and also whether or not each watt meter is behaving the same. So you might try that with a couple of different elements, and you might find that over time, they're not perfect. You know, they get a little sloppy over time.
Okay, the bird watt meter contains a very carefully generated piece of purely 50 ohm cable, about 4 inches long. And it's got a hole in the side of that 50 ohm cable, which is about an inch in diameter, the 50 ohm cable inside of the bird watt meter. And the slug that you put into it is a sampler. It is a directional coupler, which samples the signal flowing down. So if you have any reason to believe that your two different bird watt meters behave differently, the bird watt meter itself, the body of it, cannot behave differently. The slug, it can. And there's ways you can damage that slug. So when in doubt, plug the slug into bird watt meter number one, and then plug that exact same slug into bird watt meter number two. And you've got to, if an identical situation, those two experiments would have to read the same, if you know what I mean. If there's any error in your bird watt meter, the error is in the slug. And unless somebody has used a great big hammer on the inside of the body of your bird watt meter, it is not, it is a pure 50 ohm line, and it is innocent as far as errors are concerned. Now, so when you do the experiment with two bird watt meters, if the results don't make any sense, try switching the two loads, the two slugs on those bird watt meters, and the error will follow the slug, if you know what I mean. But there's a ridiculous number of people on the HF frequencies who from time to time will say that the energy read by the bird watt meter on the output end of the antenna tuner doesn't make any sense. The bird watt meter is lying to you, and that you can't do that. You're misusing the bird watt meter. And that's the equivalent of saying you can't use a bird watt meter in a system that ever has anything but a one-to-one standing wave ratio. If that was true, why are you using the bird watt meter at all in the forward and reverse mode, if you know what I mean? The fact that it's got a forward and reverse mode, and the fact that the owner's manual tells you that this ratio of forward to reverse represents that particular standing wave ratio. That's what the chart inside the owner's manual tells you. You can obviously use it in a system that's got reflective power. Okay, any further comments on this one, Gordon? And your signal was quite noisy, Gordon, but we sort of copied it. W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, let's see if I have it.
You've got it, Gordon.
right, I'm in a traffic light, I'll be quick. So, I think that the variability is how the slug interfaces to a particular bird watt meter, and that can vary between VHF and UHF, and that's where my experience is.
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, Gordon, I think you brought up another very good point. Under normal conditions, a properly constructed and properly treated bird watt meter, the body of the bird watt meter, has high mechanical integrity. And therefore, when you plug the slug into bird watt meter number one or bird watt meter number two, the exact same slug, you should read the exact same amount of energy. If anything is wrong with the mechanical mounting structure of the bird watt meter body, so that the slug gets a little bit deeper into one. That slug is a directional coupler, and how many dB down that directional coupler of the slug picks up that signal is a function of how close is the element inside that slug to the center conductor. So if there's any mechanical variation between bird watt meter number one and bird watt meter number two, so if the slug goes deeper into the machine on one compared to the other, that is one of the mechanisms by which the exact same slug will read differently on the two different bodies. But as long as your body is in good working order mechanically, as long as the slug goes the exact same depth into both machines, then the exact same slug will have to read the exact same power on two different bodies. So you brought up another very good point. Some people could damage the structure itself so that the slug goes in a different depth. There'd be two TTT if you're still there. K2RIW, over to you, Gordon.
Or if there's a problem with the slug, where it just doesn't like to feed all the time in a reasonable way, I found that to be a problem. Slugs get beat up, fried, abused, too, and so it's not a mechanical electrical problem, it's just or shall we say stress. So I think that's the big thing to think about. And I agree. The chances of having your body beat up is pretty minimal. It's probably the way the slug interfaces, and the problems are on the slug, not on the body. QRIW, I'll stand by.
Okay, with my earphones, I'm getting 100% copy, but your signal is quite noisy, and I'll repeat what Gordon was saying. So he thinks that under normal circumstances, the body of the bird watt meter, between body number one and body number two, that's not the variable. The slug itself can have a mechanical variation such that one slug gets deeper in, and the slug goes deeper at one time versus another. So the slug itself, if you have any error in the forward power or reverse power you ever read with a bird watt meter, 99% of the time that error is something wrong mechanically or electronically with the slug. So you've got to treat that slug with tender loving care in order to make sure nothing bad happens to it. I'm about to give you an example of the worst thing you can do with a bird watt meter that many people have done. It's good common sense, which is dead wrong. Let me show you this. Let me drop. Assume I'm running a moon-bounce antenna where I'm going to put a kilowatt of power into it. And I'm very carefully adjusting the impedance match of my moon-bounce antenna. It might be the feed horn of a great big dish. It might be a great big phased array of Yagis. But there's all kinds of moon-bounce antennas. But I very carefully adjusted it to be as close as a 50-ohm load, a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, as I can get. And my motivation for doing that is because the pure 50-ohm load of the antenna matches the 50-ohm impedance of my automatic noise figure indicator, and therefore, whatever noise figure I've adjusted my low noise amplifier for, I'll get the same performance on the antenna as on the automatic noise figure indicator. If the antenna is some other impedance, it will affect the performance of your low noise amplifier. So you have a strong motivation to get the standing wave ratio on your moon-bounce antenna to be a very low number. The average person, 2-to-1 is good enough. To a moon-bouncer, 2-to-1 is nowhere good enough. They want it to be 1.1 or lower. So these guys are really looking for that last little bit of performance. Let me drop. Assume you come very close to getting that performance, and you really want to confirm that the ratio of forward power to reverse power is a big number. You'd like to see 1,000 watts going forward, and you'd like to see less than 1 watt coming back when the antenna is very precisely adjusted for that moonbounce environment. Okay, with the slug that reads 1,000 watts forward in the reverse mode, when you're only measuring 1 watt coming back, the needle doesn't move. You don't see the reading on that. So it's very tempting to say, okay, in the forward mode, I'll use the 1,000 watt slug. In the reverse mode, I'll use the 10 watt slug or the 1 watt slug. Good common sense. Dead wrong. Do not do that. Because the way the slug works, the slug really is a directional coupler. There really is a dummy load resistor inside of that slug. It's something close to a 50 ohm resistor. When you're in the forward mode, the directional coupler inside of the slug picks up the power and delivers it to the meter. In the reverse mode, when you turn the slug around, the power is going, the power being picked up by your sampling probe, better known as slug, that power is going into, the forward power is going into the dummy load inside. The 50 ohm resistor is where the power is going, because the directional coupler is always, a directional coupler is a dual directional coupler. It terminated with a 50 ohm internal resistor in one direction, it terminated by the meter movement in the other direction. So you take that bird slug, which was intended for 10 watts, it's got a dummy load inside that can tolerate 10 watts, or the fraction of 10 watts that it's going to pick up, and now you're going to put a kilowatt through it. You're going to burn up that internal resistor. The bottom line is, if you think you can more accurately measure reverse power by using a more sensitive slug only in that direction, you're probably going to damage your slug. And it's a very subtle damage that you might create. You've now burned up that resistor. It's no longer 50 ohms. It now may be measuring 13 ohms, if you know what I mean. And therefore, the directivity of the slug from now on is forever damaged. Until you do some very careful measurements with laboratory equipment, you may not discover that. So let me drop once again. So if you want to measure forward and reverse power very accurately, you have to find some other way of doing it, like putting a precision voltmeter across your meter movement on the bird wattmeter in order to measure reverse power, if you know what I mean. Assuming now you've got a slug of known high directivity, and that's another whole problem. The slug itself, a very high quality slug, probably has 30 dB of directivity. That means when you put a kilowatt going forward into a perfect dummy load, and now because the dummy load is perfect, there is no power in reverse coming back. However, your particular slug in the reverse mode might read 1 watt. Because it's got 30 dB of directivity. It sees the kilowatt going forward, 1,000 watts. 30 dB down from a kilowatt is 1 watt. It will read 1 watt forward if it has 30 dB of, or 1 watt reverse, even though there really is 0 watts reverse, because it has 30 dB of activity. Every slug of every bird watt meter has a measurable amount of directivity that is part of the calibration procedure. In theory, you can open it up and make an improvement in that calibration at your particular favorite frequency. But every directional coupler has a measurable amount of directivity. A medium performance directional coupler, if you buy that rectangular device called directional coupler, a medium performance one has got 20 dB of directivity. A high quality one has got 30 dB of directivity. One made for instrumentation grade can easily have 50 dB of directivity. I own a directional coupler, a waveguide type, that has a measurable 55 dB of directivity. So the directivity of a coupler is something that's calibratable, measurable, and it's something that a lot of people don't consider. So I know I've added a bunch of extra factors as to what's going on here. So as you can tell, that bird watt meter you put after your antenna tuner, what is it going to read, forward and reverse? There's a lot of answers to that. And until you figure out the details as to what's going on, it could confuse you. Let's see if Tony has any further questions. Tony is the guy who started focus on this particular line of questioning. I hope I haven't created more confusion here, Tony. W2ASC, K2LIW. Go ahead, Tony.
No, certainly not. No, not any more confusion at all. Actually, clarification. I thank you very much. That's I'm fine.
C2IS query.
Yeah, Tony grabbed it immediately before any of the beeps occurred, and we could have almost timed it out. The person who has got a query, wait for the beeps and then give us your query. And I think it might be, I'm not sure who it is. Go right ahead, sir. K2LIW.
This is AC2IS. Bill, so you were talking about resistors that matched impedance, so in theory there'd be no reflection back from that resistor, but I believe signal can still be radiated from a resistor. It does not perfectly go to heat. I think there's still some RF that's going to leak out of there. If your goal is to take the RF down as much as possible, what other characteristics might you want on that resistor, or what other things might you want to do above and beyond using a terminating resistor to dump the energy from your rig, AC2IS?
That's who we are also.
Yeah, very fine, that, Bill. The resistor I'm talking about right now is the resistor that's built into the slug. If you took the slug apart, you'll find out it's got a pickup loop of wire, it's got a diode, it's got a very careful layout, and it's got a resistor in there. And yes, that resistor, even though it might be a micro-miniature resistor, it still has capable of doing some radiating inside of the slug itself. That's part of the calibration. Any of the signal radiated by the slug, it's either going to be in phase or out of phase with the signal being picked up by the loop of wire and the diode. And so by readjusting the loop of wire, the closeness to the center conductor of the body of the bird wattmeter, by adjusting that distance, by adjusting the resistor, by adjusting, there's probably a gimmick capacitor in there, by various techniques, the fact that the resistor inside the slug does a little bit of radiating is not a showstopper. It's going to make the calibration a little bit different, and after you've done the calibration, you now are re-establishing the directivity you desire. So the resistor inside of the slug, the fact that it may not be located in a perfectly shielded structure, that is not a showstopper once you properly adjust it. If I take my rectangular device that sits on the table, that's called a directional coupler, and I've got a terminating resistor on at least one of its ports. Let me drop. Every real directional coupler has a straight-through line input and output connector. It has a coupled line, left-hand side and right-hand side, connector. There's really four connectors in every directional coupler, rectangular directional coupler. The one that is terminated with a 50-ohm resistor might be internal to the big rectangular structure, and maybe you don't see it. In some cases, you do see it. It's on the outside. There is a resistor in there, a 50-ohm resistor, or something very close to a 50-ohm resistor. And in the ideal world, it's perfectly shielded. It doesn't do any radiating. So the radiation from your termination can change the calibration of your directional coupler, and there's ways of compensating that. You can make the terminating resistor perfectly shielded, or the fact that it's creating an error, you can compensate for that error by, let me call it, the readjustment and gimmicking devices. So to recognize that a resistor as a termination in the non-ideal world, if it's not in a perfectly shielded structure, is going to do some radiating, to recognize that is a very smart thing to do, Bill. But don't let it intimidate you into thinking you can't use a good terminating resistor. There's ways around it, perfectly shielding and compensating. AC2IS, K2IW. Go ahead, Bill. Good question.
This is AC2IS. So my thought was not necessarily related to directional couplers, but just in terms of, like, hey, if you've, so cars nowadays have some, you know, cell phone or radio-based systems built into them, or sort of Internet of Things type devices, and if you don't like that and you would like to, you know, sort of squelch that RF communication as much as possible, you know, you might think of putting a terminating resistor on in place of the antenna in that system. So that then my thinking becomes, okay, well, what's the best way potentially to do that? How do you dump as much, you know, RF as possible into a terminating resistor and get the least signal out possible? AC to IS.
Yeah, the case of your cell phone, for instance, is far from a perfectly shielded device. In fact, it's very non-shielded. And so all kinds of signals can be radiated into and out of that package. And the reason why you're now discussing perfect terminating resistors and non-radiating resistors, Bill, is because you're probably thinking of radio frequency biohazard, RF radiation. And the big mistake that the engineers made in 1900 when they were studying radio circuitry is that the signal coming out of an antenna tends to go out into space into all directions. It radiates. Therefore, they called that phenomena RF radiation. Perfectly good word in those days. Unfortunately, the word radiation has another meaning in World War II, meaning nuclear radiation. RF radiation, with rare exception, is not dangerous, particularly the RF signal coming out of a cell phone, which is well below 1 watt most of the time. It is not dangerous. To think that you have to take corrective action to make sure that your body is not being damaged by your cell phone, you're wasting your time. Not, you'd have to work real hard at taking that antenna, slapping right up against your eyeball, so to speak, to get enough RF coupling to the eyeball to potentially overheat your eye and give yourself a cataract. To try to force your cell phone to give your body damage would be extremely difficult. And the eye is the most sensitive part of a human being. Let me drop this. So all this jazz where people are worrying about the RF energy radiated by their cell phone, what they've got to do to protect themselves from it. 99% of the time, they're wasting their time. The energy coming out of cell phones is nowhere near high enough to give you, under normal working circumstances, to buy a cell phone that has a smaller amount of, what do they call it now? They don't call it black body radiation. I'm trying to think of the words that they use, the bulk effect, the watts per... the joules per per cubic meter of flesh, so to speak. Okay, you can buy cell phones that have a lower number of radiation. Well, that's a cell phone that radiates less signal. You're going to have more dropout with that cell phone. So to buy one that's got lower radiation output, the cell phone has to radiate a signal in order to talk to that cell site. So you try to buy a cell phone that has less radiation out of it. You think you're protecting yourself. You're really hurting your ability to use that cell phone. So was it the biohazard that you're concerned about when it comes to radiation of the dummy load and whether or not you could, if you want to, take your cell phone and put it into a perfect shielded small, what we call a Faraday shield is the word they use. A highly conductive six-sided cube, and you put the cell phone into it. You could make a box around your cell phone that gives you easily 60 dB of isolation, 60 dB of shielding. 60 dB is a 1,000,000-to-1 ratio. So 1 watt being radiated by your cell phone, only a microwatt could get out of that cage if you put that cell phone in that cage. You're not going to talk to a cell site, but if that's the experiment you want to do, if you think it's required to protect your body from biohazard. Over to you, Bill. Here we go. AC2IS, K2RIW. You got it, Bill.
W2CCC info on LTE.
This is Bill, AC2IS. And, I'm not trying to protect my eyeballs here. the idea is, yeah, there's a cell phone built into a car, and there are some people that don't like that fact. You know, they're fine with having a cell phone in their pocket, say, and irradiating their eyeballs with that phone, but they don't like the idea that their car is cell phone connected or cell network connected, because car companies, you know, automotive engineers are really good at making, you know, cars that drive well on the road, but they're not really good at, you know, internet security type threats. So presumably the car has remotely exploitable vulnerabilities that you might want to, you know, shut down or prevent. And possibly the best way to do that is just eliminate the ability of the cell phone that's built into the car to communicate. So putting the entire car in a Faraday cage might be effective in taking the signal, the cell phone signal of the car down by 60 dB, but would probably make the car somewhat less effective as a car. So the idea is, oh, okay, you can probably put a terminating resistor in place of your cell phone antenna without mucking up the rest of the systems in the car, and then what else do you have to do if 60 dB down is enough to, say, you know, prevent cell phone communication even when you're within, say, 1,000 feet of a cell tower? You know, is that enough? Or, you know, cell towers are really sensitive. You know, is it ever possible to get to a point where you've diminished your output of that car phone to the point where you'd never have to worry about it being able to communicate with a cell tower, AC2IS?
I can make some good comments, Dick, on the subject, M2EL.
Some comments about LTE signal levels and exposure.
Yeah, we got two people in the wings here. Rich first, and then Gordon second. Go ahead there, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Oh, okay, Dick. Like you said, radiation is not radiation. Nuclear radiation will kill you. RF radiation is harmless. Totally harmless. The reason I know that, you know Barry M2MB. He was working on the top floor of the Empire State Building when NBC was located there. They were bathed in RF. They had to put bypass capacitors in voltmeters because they would pick up so much RF, the meters didn't work properly. Other equipment didn't work properly. They all had to do that there. Now, at one point, they sent all the technicians up there for examinations. They all came back, no harm to them. Nothing. People go idiots, say they don't know what they're talking about. And then I have a comment, I want to ask a question that goes before on the birdwatch meter.
QFIU, he's totally wrong.
Yeah, hold on that one, George. RF energy, when it hits a human being, the portion that gets absorbed gets turned into heat. That's all it does. And it's a rather small amount of heat in any reasonable situation. It's a non-accumulative effect. RF energy does not accumulate, per se. Nuclear radiation does accumulate, and therefore, if I give you a certain amount of nuclear radiation today and a certain amount again tomorrow, to some degree you add the two together, where RF energy, 1 milliwatt per square centimeter today and 1 milliwatt per square centimeter tomorrow, they do not add together. So RF energy, because it's called radiation, gets confused. I know that Gordon wants to give us some words on this. We're not going to go back to the bird watt meter immediately. We're going to stick with this RF radiation at first for a little bit longer, Rich, so hang in there. Gordon, what are you telling us about LTE? W2 Tango Tango Tango, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Exceptionally brief. Number LTE will work down to about minus 115 dBm. That's 600 milliwatts is about the high power, so think, you know, 27, 28 dBm, somewhere in there. So,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Communicate pretty effectively at some portion of the footprint of a cell site. Also, as far as exposure goes, the uplink from the cell phone is pretty minimal in its duration. Very lightweight. The downlink is much more persistent, and in fact, it is 100% persistent. The uplink is a shared channel and does not have the duty cycle of exposure you really have to worry about. And also, there's just not much.
Yeah, Gordon, you're in a pretty noisy area right now. We're only getting about the 60% copy. But you did say something rather interesting. The minus 115 dBm LTE, a good cell phone, or maybe the cell site itself, has that kind of sensitivity, rather weak signal. Let's see, that's a small fraction of a microvolt. Minus 107 dBm on a 50 ohm system is 1 microvolt. So 115 is 8 more dB. It's about a quarter of a microvolt. Pretty darn sensitive. So, a cell phone held near a human being, whatever RF energy you do absorb only gets turned into heat. And it's an extremely minor amount of heat. In other words, if you held the cell phone near your stomach, say for instance 4 inches away from your stomach, and you did a careful laboratory experiment, and you held the cell phone there for a long time, you might be able to measure, I am guessing, a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit increase in the skin of your stomach that's closest to the cell phone. You know, that kind of heating characteristic. And can your body be damaged by a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit of extra heat? You can much, much more than that by just lying in the sun on a summer day when you're on the beach, if you know what I mean. So RF energy is nowhere near as dangerous as you think. And the factor I was trying to think of before is watts per kilogram. I think they give you various readings on various cell phones of the watts per kilogram that it radiates. And you think that by choosing the lower number, you've got a safer cell phone. You're really going to have a cell phone with a smaller amount of the range to it. Let's see. What else were you about to say about a bird watt meter, Rich? N2EO on the bird watt meter, K2LIW listening.
Okay, Dick, thank you for letting me in with that. I was in the dining room eating, so I only heard parts of that conversation. I used to have a bird with a bunch of slugs, but you know what happened to it? I'm not going to bring it up, but you know. I want to buy a new one, and new slugs. Couple of questions. There's a competing company. There's a competing company called Dielectric. Oh, it's a meter and the socks is as good as a bird. I believe they're a little less expensive. Also, you know I use open wireline here extendly. Does the bird or Dielectric or maybe a third party make a transformer that you can plug into your bird watt meter on to read the output and connect open wireline to it? To my knowledge, it does not exist. on the dummy hood. Okay, on the dummy hood, I have a nice one here. It's a dummy hood with a built-in watt meter. It reads forward power, reflected power on the dummy hood. It's called, it's made by MFJ. It's an MFJ, I'm looking, 267. 267. And don't worry, MFJ has improved their quality tremendously. They're no longer mighty fine junk. There were two, I understood from a AES before they went out of business. The dealers were all complaining about too many returns. And they refused to buy any more stuff from MFJ unless they improved their quality. And they did. Back to you, Dick, and to Rio.
Yeah, I've heard of the number, I've heard of the brand name of Dielectric, as well as Bird, when it comes to directional power meters, directional watt meters. And I think Dielectric is a fairly respected brand. There are people who have been using Dielectric, and they're happy with it. And both of those machines, the Dielectric and the Bird watt meter, to my knowledge, are set up for a 50-ohm coaxial system. Your next question is going to be, can I use it in a 70-ohm system? And the answer is not directly. It's not going to explode if you put it into a 70-ohm system, a 70-ohm transmission line, where the internal impedance of the Bird watt meter is 50 ohms. If you try to read those results and use them directly, you're going to be in trouble. There are ways you can compensate. There are ways you can calibrate. There are ways you can live with a 70-ohm transmission line with a 50-ohm Bird watt meter. But in general, it's more complicated, so be careful on that one. But the machine itself is a pure coaxial system. They do not make balance for launching signals into open wire line. You have to supply that yourself. I can see how Bird or Dielectric would never take on that responsibility. There's too many ways that can go wrong. You have to pick up that responsibility of you supplying the balancing device. And you, therefore, if you're a good scientist, you have to find ways of adjusting, calibrating, and evaluating your balancing device that launches a signal between a unbalanced 50-ohm system versus a balanced line, you know, a 400-ohm, 300-ohm, 450-ohm, 600-ohm balanced line. The device that does the impedance matching between the two, you have to supply that, you have to calibrate that, and that's not an easy thing to do. It's doable, but to do it with high accuracy is not easy. I'll warn you on that one. Okay, I know we've gone very far left of center, Roy, with the original question that was asked on your mailbag with reference to the Bird watt meter and the bouncing signals with antennas. But hopefully we've all learned a little something with this. I may have made some errors, in which case next week we'll be correcting those errors. But discussing RF on these areas that are highly misunderstood, directional couplers, Bird watt meters, antennas, and the loss of connectors at RF frequencies. These are all subjects that are highly misunderstood. Standing wave ratio in general is highly misunderstood. So we're going to have to discuss these subjects a lot before it becomes a little bit more understandable for our general listening audience. AC2GS, sorry to take you so long on this one, Roy. K2LIW, you got it, Roy.
Thanks, Dick. No reason to be sorry. I enjoyed the heck out of it. It's reminiscent of the good old days when John, KC2WGB, was doing the mailbag and such, and that's why people tune in to listen to you tell these technological tales. So I enjoyed it immensely.
Okay. Do you think we've answered 80% of your submitter's questions? Should we drop that subject for tonight? And probably the answer is yes. We've been on it for a long enough period of time, and maybe you'd like to go to your next subject. The choice is yours, Roy, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, this is really your show. I just come and play in it. So So you decide one way or the other. I mean, the way that I use the example of the 100 watts and the 20% reflection in the answer to Chris's first question, which probably elicited his question of what the heck a antenna tuner that does things like that entails. So I've learned my lessons well. So it's up to you. I do want to just add as a little bit of thing that I feel easier when I think about these things as thinking about antenna systems as opposed to antennas and transmission lines. They work well better in my mind if I put them together. The transmission line might rotate the impedances, but I take them as a combined phenomena. So that you can do the impedance matching or the magical electronic resonance either inside the antenna element or at the very beginning of the transmission line to them. So that's just what I works in my brain.
So to re-quote what I think you just said, Roy, because only in the very early days of ham radio, back in, let me pick a number, 1920, where many of the houses were wooden and the ham radio operator was confined to the attic and he was on, let's say, the 40-meter ham band. And so on his wooden table in the attic, he's got a 40-meter transmitter and he's going to set up a 40-meter dipole, which is 67 feet long, 32 feet on each side. He's going to put one 32-foot piece of wire from that wooden table out the eastern window and another 32-foot piece of wire out the western window. So he had his transmitter in the middle of the dipole, and the dipole was going out the two windows of the wooden house in the attic where he was located. Well, later on, we hams decided we wanted to work down into the living quarters of the house, so you needed a transmission line. So we've added transmission lines to antennas. But in the very beginning, the transmitter and the antenna were one and the same. What I think you're saying, Roy, is that you like to lump the two together. You know that the transmission line, in some cases, is going to do some kind of an impedance modification of the true impedance of the antenna. But by lumping the two together, by taking antenna plus transmission line at a particular fixed frequency, and by your antenna analyzer measuring it, it is one single black box, which has really got two components, transmission line plus antenna. And you'd like to consider it as one composite item, is what I think you're saying, and I think that can definitely be made to work. AC2GS, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, exactly. I mean, you know, different people's brain works in slightly different ways. That kind of way of looking at an antenna system tends to work for me. For those people who like to segment things and think of a transmission line is completely different than a radiating antenna, so be it. I have found it easier to figure out how things sort of work if I bind them together into an antenna system as opposed to an antenna and a separate transmission line.
Someone's comment?
Comment, I'll pick you up in a second. You're absolutely right, Roy. Though there are a few guys out there that are a little bit more of a scientist. They like digging into the nitty-gritty. And they might use their antenna tuner directly on the antenna, measure that impedance, then plug in the transmission line and re-measure it and say, gee, it's different. What happened? And there's ways of calculating that. If you know the impedance of your transmission line, and if you know its length electronically or physically and knowing its velocity factor, which is the same thing, you can predict what the modified impedance is going to be. There's a not too difficult to use equation you can plug into a handheld calculator these days, which will allow you to calculate what is the impedance in the shack for any reasonable length of any reasonable transmission line. You can calculate that if you care to do that. The person who had a further question, please tell us your call letters and name. K2RIW listening.
K2RIW in the group. This is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray Mike. Rich. I should point out that the transmission line and the antenna are the two most obvious parts of the antenna system. But as the ARL books themselves point out, the antenna system also includes all sorts of other factors, including the operator himself, the environment of the shack, the environment the antenna is in, the ground, the counterpoise, the radials, everything, and basically everything. It comprises the antenna system, WE2GXM.
You brought up a very good point, Rich. If I'm measuring the characteristics of an amplifier in a laboratory, it's got an input connector, an output connector, a plus 15 volt lead on it, so to speak. And so with good instrumentation, I can measure the forward power, the gain, the phase shift, the reverse reflection coefficient, the input standing wave ratio, the upper standing, I can measure all of those things. When you bring an antenna into an antenna testing laboratory, and you think you're measuring the antenna as a black box like you did with that amplifier, oh boy, it turns out that every antenna, because it's radiating some amount of signal into every direction of space, you're measuring the antenna plus its environment. And you have to accept the fact that multipath RF is a very prevalent thing. Every signal that has ever come out of any one of your antennas is hitting every single object in your environment. Some amount of signal is hitting everything. The ground, the grass, the tower, the house, the gutters on the house next door, and so on. Signals are bouncing off of all of that. And all of those bounce signals, some of it go back to the antenna, changing its impedance a little bit. Some of that signal being bounced goes over to your test antenna, your sampling antenna, and modifies what it sees. So that, except for an ideal anechoic chamber, every real environment has got all kinds of multipass reflections taking place, and therefore it makes the testing more complicated. If you're smart enough, there are ways of compensating for all of that. There are ways of living with all of that. But if you're a little bit naive and you don't know all of that multipath bouncing is taking place, then sometimes your measurements are going to sound a little bit crazy. That you may measure the antenna in the middle of an ideal anechoic chamber and you think it's a 50 ohm antenna. Then you move that antenna into your backyard, mount it on top of your wooden stepladder, and it's 5 feet above the ground, and you measure an impedance that's different. And you wonder what happened. And so I think that's what you're getting at here. And it's a good point there, Rich. It'll be B2GXM, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beeps.
K2LIW, WB2GXM. For ham purposes, ultimately, it's convenient to ignore all the extraneous extra factors involved in the antenna system and focus on the transmission line and the antenna itself. For most of our measurements, if they're off a little bit, no one really cares or minds, especially at HF. When you get into the high frequencies, you have to take a little bit more care. WB2GXM.
So, once we decided we're testing an antenna, we have to accept the fact that the environment around the antenna makes a big difference on what you measure as what you think is the gain, the bandwidth, and the standing wave ratio, and all those other characteristics. Particularly if you want to measure front-to-side ratio and side lobe amplitudes and front-to-back ratio. Oh boy, the environment can really drive you crazy. Your real antenna may have a front-to-back ratio of 15 dB. In that particular environment you're testing it, it may look like it's only got to a 7 dB of front-to-back ratio, or you move it around a little bit or move the frequency a little bit, and you may measure 30 dB of directional front-to-back ratio when it's really 15. So that environment and the signal reflecting off of it can make the apparent front-to-back bigger than real or smaller than real. And these voltages add in a voltage manner, but when you convert them to dBs, boy, all kind of crazy things happen. The good things about decibels is it's a compressed scale. You can take a million to one ratio, and you write down a million to one, it's a big number. You write it down in decibels, it's only 60 dB, 6.60. What decibels do is they take strong signals and compress them. They take weak signals and expand them. If you've got a null the voltage goes to zero. When you're plotting the voltage, plotting zero as opposed to plotting 1 volt, that's easy. If you're doing it in decibels, zero is minus infinity in dB, or 0.01 microvolt might be minus 100 dB. So decibels, they have this crazy characteristic of compressing strong signals and expanding weak signals. That doesn't mean you should stop using decibels. You have to learn to live with their crazy characteristics, their idiosyncrasies, if you know what I mean. In many cases, decibels are a huge advantage when it comes to measuring antenna characteristics, amplifier characteristics. Decibels are very handy numbers. A person being exposed to this logarithmic mathematical function called decibels, when he's first exposed to that, oh boy, it'll drive you up a wall. It'll drive you up a wall for a while. We're getting into some tongue twisters here. Roy, I better hit it back to you. AC2GS, K2IW, and the TechNet. Go to the next one if you'd like to. W.